Today is Monday, June 21st, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, uncertainty over Iran nuclear talks.
It is in the interest of both Russia and the United States to ensure that Iran does not acquire nuclear weapons. We agreed to work together.
Plus, UN probes reports of human rights violations in some countries.
The Council also will hear updates on the human rights situation in other countries, including Eritrea, Iran, Nicaragua, South Sudan, and Syria.
Also, Sweden Prime Minister loses a confidence vote in Parliament. Our top story today is in the Middle East. Uncertainty surrounds international negotiations to curb Iran's nuclear program following the election of a new hardline president. The issue came up recently at a meeting between the U.S. and Russian presidents. Michelle Quinn reports.
The election of hardliner Ibrahim Raisi comes days after U.S. President Joe Biden said he and Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin discussed Iran at their recent summit in Geneva.
It is in the interest of both Russia and the United States to ensure that Iran does not acquire nuclear weapons. We agreed to work together.
In April, nuclear negotiations began with Iran to re-enter the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which put limits on Iran's atomic activities in exchange for easing international sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Iran pulled back from its nuclear commitments after then-President Donald Trump in 2018 pulled the U.S. out of the agreement and reimposed U.S. sanctions on Tehran. The U.S. is taking part in indirect talks in Vienna, Austria, with diplomats from five nations acting as go-betweens with Iran. Iran's foreign minister said a deal could be reached later this year before the new president takes office. The White House is not signaling any breakthroughs in negotiations, but appears to be cautiously optimistic about the direction of the talks. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan spoke on ABC's This Week program.
What I would say is that there is still a fair distance to travel on some of the key issues, including on sanctions and on the nuclear commitments that Iran has to make. But the arrow has been pointed in the right direction in terms of the work that's getting done in Vienna.
Negotiators adjourned the latest round of talks on Sunday to consult with their respective governments, with no set date to resume. Iran maintains its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
President-elect Ibrahim Raisi said on Monday Iran's foreign policy priority will be improving ties with Gulf Arab neighbors while calling on regional rival Saudi Arabia to halt its intervention in Yemen immediately. Raisi, a hardliner and strident critic of the West, will take over from pragmatist Hassan Rouhani in August as Iran seeks to restore the tattered nuclear deal and end of U.S. sanctions that have crippled Iran's economy. Regional governments reacted with little surprise to Raisi's victory in Iran's election, and it is unclear if the winner will be able to improve relations with Iran's Arab neighbors while he takes office. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
A number of Iranian political leaders had called on the Iranian people to boycott the election, among them former hardline President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and People's Mujahideen leader Miriam Rajavi. Official turnout was under 50% of eligible voters, while 8 to 10% of ballots cast were void. Former Iranian diplomat Mirdad Khansari told VOA that the vote was a clear disavowal by the Iranian public of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei and of the deep state apparatus that runs the country.
This is a positive development in the sense that it places the deep state squarely in front of the people. Khamenei and his cronies no longer have any contractors to present a different face of the true nature of their regime to the outside world and to the Iranian people.
Khansari stressed that Iran's moderate reform movement, which reportedly won 2009's presidential election before the government backtracked on the results, was also repudiated by voters. The election, he says, showed the lack of confidence the public had in any remnants of the reform movement who were not able to get their act straight or act in a cohesive manner to stand with the majority of Iranians to boycott the election. Former Iranian President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who lives in exile in Paris, said in a statement that the vote consecrated the imposition of a president on the Iranian people, whom he insisted refused to accept it. The Iranian people, with their collective conscience, he argued, refused to accept the imposition of a man known by history as a murderer. Amnesty International also castigated Raisi for his alleged role in death squads that killed innocent civilians during the country's 2019 protests, as well as for killings that reportedly took place during the late 1980s. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei claimed in a statement issued Saturday that the Iranian people were the winners of Friday's presidential election and that nothing stopped them from going out to vote. Arab states made little apparent effort to congratulate Raisi for winning the election, other than Iraq and Syria, which have close ties to Tehran. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Negotiators for Iran and six world powers on Sunday adjourned talks on reviving their 2050 nuclear deal for consultations in their capitals, officials said. Parties to the pact wrapped up after more than a week of negotiations in the latest round, and Russia's envoy said no date for resumption talks has been set for now, although he suggested they could return in about 10 days. Negotiations have been going on in Vienna since April to work out the nature and sequencing of steps Iran and the United States must take on nuclear activities and sanctions to return to full compliance with the nuclear pact. Iran's top negotiator Abbas Araghchi gives an update on the talks.
We are closer to a deal than any time in the past, but it doesn't mean that we are there. The remaining job is still difficult and needs lots of, you know, efforts and further talks. So we decided to cut negotiations here, go back home, not only for consultations, but this time for decision making.
That's Iran's top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi. On Monday, Iran's president-elect Raisi said he has no intention of meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden. Israel Prime Minister Naftali Bennett called on Western leaders to cancel further nuclear talks with Iran following the election of Ebrahim Raisi as president. Raisi, who is under U.S. sanctions for human rights abuses, secured victory as expected on Saturday in Iran's presidential election after a contest marked by voter apathy over economic hardships and political restrictions.
This weekend, Iran chose a new president, Ebrahim Raisi. Of all the people that Khamenei could have chosen, he chose the hangman of Tehran, the man infamous among Iranians and across the world for leading the death committees, which executed thousands of innocent Iranian citizens throughout the years. Raisi's selection is, I would say, the last chance for the world powers to wake up before returning to the nuclear agreement and to understand who they're doing business with. These guys are murderers, mass murderers. A regime of brutal hangmen must never be allowed to have weapons of mass destruction that will enable it to not to kill thousands, but millions. Israel's position will not change on this.
That's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. The United States' new top envoy for North Korea said on Monday in Seoul that looks forward to a, quote, positive response soon, unquote, on dialogue from North Korea. Gloria Tso of Reuters reports.
Days after North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un said to prepare for confrontation but also dialogue with the United States, on Monday the new top U.S. envoy to Pyongyang, Sung Kim, said he hopes for a positive response soon on talks with the North. Ambassador Kim is in South Korea for a five-day visit as denuclearization talks with Pyongyang have stalled.
We are still waiting to hear back from Pyongyang on our proposal for a meeting. And hopefully Chairman Kim's reference to dialogue indicates that we would get a positive response soon.
In the meantime, Kim said the U.S. will continue to enforce U.N. Security Council resolutions imposing sanctions on North Korea and urged other countries to do the same. Kim, who doubles as ambassador to Indonesia, held back-to-back meetings with South Korea's top nuclear envoy, No Kyu-duk, as well as trilateral talks with Japanese counterpart Takehiro Funakoshi. His appointment came after the Biden administration announced it would seek, quote, calibrated and practical ways of prompting Pyongyang to give up its nuclear weapons. Washington said Sunday it saw Kim Jong-un's latest comments as an interesting signal, but added they were still waiting for direct communication from Pyongyang regarding denuclearization.
That was Gloria Tso of Reuters. Ethiopians queued up early in Addis Ababa on Monday morning for an election that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has billed as proof of his democratic credentials, though some Ethiopians disagree. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
Voters lined up early in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa on Monday to vote in national and regional elections. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has billed the poll as proof of his commitment to democracy after decades of repressive rule. Marketing director Yetayu Solomon was among those up early to vote.
More than anything, I will vote for a party which I think will bring peace to our country, and I finalized my decision.
In the last election, before Abiy came to power, the ruling coalition and its allies won all 547 seats in parliament. This time, more than 37 million of Ethiopia's 109 million population are registered to vote, choosing from 46 parties. Candidates in the crowded field are mostly from smaller, ethnically based parties, and Abiy's newly formed Prosperity Party is the front runner. The Nobel Peace Prize laureate has overseen sweeping political and economic reforms since being appointed leader of Ethiopia's ruling coalition 3 years ago. But some rights activists say those gains are being reversed and complain of abuses in a war in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The government denies the charges. Some political parties are also boycotting the vote, alleging intimidation. Problems with voting registration and simmering ethnic violence have delayed the poll in a fifth of constituencies, and a second round of voting will take place in September.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. Stefan Löfven, Sweden's Social Democratic Prime Minister since 2014, has lost a confidence vote in parliament, making him the first Swedish government leader ever to lose such a motion. The vote was initiated Tuesday by the small left party, an ally of the minority government that is not in the two-party center-left coalition. A key trigger for the vote were frustrations over plans to reform Sweden's housing market because of accelerating price increases during the pandemic. It is unclear what will happen next in Sweden. Löfven said last week he would wait for the vote and then, quote, think through what is best for Sweden, unquote. Australia is asking the World Trade Organization to intervene in its dispute with China over the imposition of anti-dumping duties on Australian wine exports. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Relations between Australia and China, its biggest trading partner, are at their worst in decades. There's been diplomatic friction over regional geopolitical flashpoints, including Beijing's growing military ambitions in the South China Sea. Tensions escalated last year when Australia demanded an inquiry into the origins of the new coronavirus, which was first detected in China in late 2019. It was a move that infuriated Beijing, where it was interpreted as criticism of its handling of the pandemic. Since then, China has imposed tough economic sanctions on a range of Australian commodities. Beijing accused Australia of illegally subsidising its wine producers, and in November announced additional import taxes of more than 200% on Australian wine for 5 years. China was Australia's most valuable wine export market, but the duties have almost killed off that lucrative trade. Australian officials have denied the wine industry has been subsidised, as China has alleged. Australia's ambassador in Beijing said China's campaign of economic punishment against his country was vindictive. Prime Minister Scott Morrison also warned that his government would respond to economic coercion. Canberra has said it will now appeal China's tariffs on wine exports to the World Trade Organization. Australian Trade Minister Dan Tehan.
In March this year, the Chinese government put countervailing duties on Australian wine ranging between 116% to 220%. That has had a serious impact on the Australian wine industry, Our exports have fallen from $1.1 billion to approximately $20 million. As a result, and following close consultation with the Australian wine industry, and I thank them for the cooperative way they've worked with the government, we've decided to take this wine dispute to the World Trade Organization.
The action came just days after a summit of the G7 grouping of advanced economies. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is the Voice of America. The Tokyo Olympics will allow some local fans to attend when the games open in just about a month. This goes against the country's top medical advisor, who has recommended the safest way during the COVID-19 pandemic is without any fans. Overseas fans were banned several months ago. Japanese organizers have set a set limit of 50% of the capacity, up to a minimum of 10,000 fans for all Olympic venues. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Hong Kong's pro-democracy newspaper, Apple Daily, said Monday its board of directors has asked authorities to unfreeze some assets so it can pay salaries and avoid labor violations. The board will meet again on Friday to decide if the newspaper will cease operations. Police last week arrested five top editors and executives of Apple Daily under the city's tough national security law on suspicion of foreign collusion, searched its offices, and froze $2.3 million worth of assets of three companies linked to the newspaper. Media and textile tycoon Jimmy Lai founded the newspaper and its parent company, Next Media. Lai, an advocate of greater democracy in Hong Kong, is now in prison on charges of illegal assembly. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has issued a stark warning that rising poverty, inequality, injustice, and erosion of democratic values were gravely setting back the course of human rights around the world. Bachelet addressed delegates at the opening of the UN Human Rights Council three-week session. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In her opening remarks, Bachelet called for action to stop what she called the most wide-reaching and severe cascade of human rights setbacks in our lifetime. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights backed up her assertion by zipping through the human rights records of dozens of countries around the world. No region escaped her withering gaze. She noted the Council would hold special interactive dialogues on several places of specific concern, including Iran, Myanmar, Venezuela, and the occupied Palestinian territories. She expressed alarm at the sharp increase in violence and civilian harm in Afghanistan and warned the imminent withdrawal of international forces was creating fear for the future. She deplored the deterioration of freedoms of expression in Belarus and said reports of continued arbitrary arrests and torture of human rights activists was of great concern.
In the Tigray region of Ethiopia, I'm deeply disturbed by continued reports of serious violation of international humanitarian law and gross human rights violations and abuses against civilians by all parties to the conflict, including extrajudicial executions, arbitrary arrests and detentions, sexual violence against children as well as adults, and forced displacement.
In many other parts of Ethiopia, Bachelet warned alarming incidents of deadly ethnic and intercommunal violence and displacement were increasing polarization to a more dangerous level. She urged dialogue throughout the country to address these grievances. Even powerful permanent members of the UN Security Council did not escape condemnation. The High Commissioner criticized the application of China's national security law in Hong Kong. She noted this was having a chilling impact on the territory's civic and democratic space. She reiterated her request for access to China's Xinjiang region, where an estimated 1 million Uyghur Muslims allegedly are being held in abusive internment camps.
In the Russian Federation, I am dismayed by recent measures that further undermines people's right to express critical views and their ability to take part in the parliamentary election schedule in September. Earlier this month, following close hearings, a court in Moscow ruled that the Anti-Corruption Foundation, led by the imprisoned opposition figure Alexei Navalny, was an extremist organization.
She urged Russia to uphold civil and political rights and to refrain from branding ordinary individuals, journalists, and non-governmental organizations as extremist or foreign agents. Bachelet called for concerted action to recover from these grave human rights setbacks. She said societies must restore systems of justice, reduce inequalities, and lift people out of poverty through human rights-based development to create better, more resilient societies for future generations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN's top human rights body opened its latest session and was immediately embroiled in a debate over the representation of Myanmar, where a military coup toppled the civilian government in February. Western states lined up to insist that two planned debates on the human rights situation in Myanmar at the Human Rights Council should go forward even without the country represented, but China, the Philippines, and Venezuela countered that it should be. Families in the Tigray region of Ethiopia continue to be forced to flee war, often only to be displaced again by violence or the massive social and economic strain caused by the crisis. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from Shire, Ethiopia.
At this camp in the Tigray region of Ethiopia, families pack up their things swiftly. But it isn't much. Most of their belongings were left behind when they fled the war. Soldiers here say the university campus where these families are being hosted needs to open and people have to leave immediately. Vehicles that locals call bajajas line up to transport people and goods at cheap prices as another camp is set up across town.
They told us we have to leave a month ago, and since then they have come every few days. The only difference is now they are using force.
UN officials briefly visit, saying the new camp is not ready and the move is unjust. But they quickly concede to local forces and tell people to follow the soldiers' orders. Worldwide, an estimated more than 80 million people are displaced from their homes, forced to flee war or persecution. Nearly 60% remain in their home countries, sometimes forced to flee the same conflict over and over again. In Tigray, many displaced families were split up in the chaos, with about 2 million people fleeing within Ethiopia and more than 60,000 people crossing the border to take refuge in Sudan.
So many people fled to Sudan, but I was pregnant and couldn't get that far.
After she fled, she says, her husband was arrested and her cattle confiscated. She says she cannot imagine raising four children in the camp, but she also does not think it will ever be safe to go home. The war in Tigray began last November when the Tigray People's Liberation Front attacked northern federal bases and the Ethiopian National Defense Force swept through the region. Eritrean forces are fighting with the federal government, and both sides also have associated militias. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Shire, Ethiopia.
The European Union's top diplomat says the bloc's foreign ministers are set to approve new sanctions against more than 80 of officials in Belarus and prepare new measures aimed at hurting the country's economy. The EU has ramped up sanctions since President Alexander Lukashenko won a sixth term last August. In elections, the 27-nation bloc says were fraudulent. The new sanctions target people accused of electoral misconduct and responsibility for the police crackdown that followed. The ministers will also finalize sanctions aimed at Belarus's economy. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said Monday that, quote, these are going to hurt the economy of Belarus heavily, unquote. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a good evening.
My name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests, and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.